The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Larkin, Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning. Today's date is October 7, 2020. This is the second case set for oral argument today before this panel. It's case number A20-0468, Dahl versus Quinn. We have counsel for appellant. We are conducting this oral argument via Zoom. Counsel for appellant is present, both by video and by audio. We've had some technical difficulties connecting with counsel for respondent. So after 15 minutes of efforts to resolve that, we have decided to go ahead as best we can by receiving oral argument from appellant in favor of reversal. And we will see whether by the end of that time, whether a respondent has been able to make a connection. So Mr. Casper, on behalf of appellant, Ms. Quinn, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Mr. Tanek and Ms. Eileen, who I see has joined the call. My name is Josh Casper and I represent appellant Ms. Pamela Quinn. On February 24th, 2018, Judge Raincourt of the Chisago County District Court appointed Pam Quinn to conduct a custody evaluation in an underlying matter, ATB Besta v. Olson. Olson, in that matter, for all times relevant to this proceeding, was the fiance of the respondent. She is now respondent's wife. On July 2nd, 2018, Olson's attorney made a joint request to amend the scheduling order, allowing for additional time for pretrial submissions. That request was predicated on the fact that the parties and their attorneys were going to be meeting with Ms. Quinn to review her recommendations for the custody evaluation.
Counsel, this is Judge Larkin. I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Getting to the heart of the matter, we're here on to review the district court's refusal to dismiss under Rule 12. And the district court, as I review the record, was presented with documents beyond the pleading and elected not to consider those documents, not to treat this as a motion for summary judgment. You've just described a continuance, why it was requested, and the motivation for it. Is any of that part of the record before us? In other words, is that beyond pleadings?
Yes, sir. The answer referred to, when we look at the pleadings, our answer to the amended complaint attached the order appointing Ms. Quinn as custody evaluator.
I understand.
The court did decline to expand the record. That's correct. The underlying custody matter, while not in the pleadings, certainly is a matter for which this court and the trial court, even beyond the pleadings, is allowed to take judicial notice. And
but, counsel, I wonder if you've gone, judicial notice allows us to recognize undisputed facts. You're saying, here's the reason the judge gave this continuance. Is that set forth in undisputed factual findings by the district court?
The court in our matter did not reference there wasn't a dispute as to the letter on July 2nd or the trial court's approval of that request on July 3rd. The interpretation of that order, I think, was in dispute, but the actual fact of it has not been disputed. The fact that the letter was submitted.
Given that we're here on review of a Rule 12 motion to dismiss, it would seem to me that the only record before us is the complaint and the assertions made therein, as well as any documents that were referenced in the complaint. I think the law allows us to do that. So we could look at the order appointing the custody evaluation. But I question whether orders in other cases are properly before this court in a Rule 12 review, given that the district court expressly said it was not going to go beyond the pleadings and convert this to a summary judgment determination.
Okay. Yes, the trial court made that determination. I believe that specific letter and what I would believe is a subsequent order entered on the third and the parallel file, while beyond the record, I don't believe at any point was objected to in reference. I believe it was brought up in our primary motion. It wasn't objected to in the respondents' reply motion the respondents' memorandum of law in this particular motion. And in fact, the respondent in this matter extends the records as well in their pleadings before this court.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
You're telling me things I know, but what I want to stress to you, and then maybe we can move on to another point, is you could have delayed in bringing the issue of immunity to the court until after there had been discovery, a more fully developed record, and you could have made that request in summary judgment. You elected to ask the district court to dismiss the pleading on the legal theory that it fails to state a claim on which relief can be granted, your argument being your client is entitled to immunity on three grounds as a matter of law. You chose to raise the issue in that context. The district court refused to treat the issue or view the issue in another context, that is summary judgment with a fully developed record. So we're stuck with the proceeding you elected, which really limits us to the pleading and the order referenced in the pleading. We can't look beyond what did this one say in a motion, what did this one say in a memo. I mean, we're looking at pleadings here. And the standard is, when we say with certainty, we can imagine no set of facts under which Mr. Dahl, or no set of facts under which, you know, you could not have, your client could not have immunity.
Thank you, Your Honor. You're correct.
Let me ask this question. As I understand it, all three forms of immunity or privilege that you claim require a finding or a conclusion that Ms. Quinn was acting within the scope of her court-ordered appointment, her judicial duties, and that applies across the board. How can we on this record conclude that there's no possibility of Mr. Dahl presenting facts that show Ms. Quinn went beyond the scope of her judicial appointment in this case?
Thank you, Your Honor. In terms of the, did she exceed beyond her authority, we would look back at the pleadings, and that specific allegation is not made in the pleadings. It's not made in the complaint.
Does the allegation need to be made in the pleadings? I mean, we're a notice pleading state. Is there a requirement that the complaint needs to refute all possible defenses, or does the complaint just need to put your client on notice of what the general claims are?
Well, the complaint would have to state a cause of action that can survive a Rule 12 motion, and allowing a case to proceed against a court-appointed custody evaluator through discovery defeats the very question of immunity. We've seen in other cases, Kubreka, for instance. In Kubreka, there was allegations of fraud in the procurement of the appointment. And so quasi-judicial immunity didn't attach because it happened prior to that individual's appointment as a custody evaluator. We have seen allegations of negligence, failure to investigate claims fully, conspiracies, not being able to defeat motion to dismiss, such as Tyndale versus Rogoszewski. If we allow cases to proceed all the way through discovery, it would still defeat the very question of immunity if immunity were to attach.
So
There's
counsel,
no question in this part.
It would be a different case indeed if the challenge statements had been made in the report that was submitted to the court. But here we have a situation where the challenge statements are made at a meeting outside of the formal court process, and there is the legitimate argument made, well, that's beyond the scope of the duties. Here's what the order says, here's what the statute says. On this record, the district court seemed to have reasoned it couldn't conclude as a matter of law that your client was entitled to immunity. Maybe facts will be developed that allow you to raise the issue again. But at this point of time, if we assume all facts in the plaintiff's favor, and we look at the pleading and the order, and we can, I suppose, look at the statute, we would say, well, this doesn't appear to be within the scope of duties, at least at this point in the litigation. It's a possibility.
Okay. Specifically referencing that, and what's been acknowledged by all parties in this case, is the order appointing her was two paragraphs long. Mm-hmm. It did not limit her to the duties under 518.167, the custody evaluation statute. It, in fact, didn't reference it at all. It just stated she was supposed to conduct a custody evaluation. The broad manner in which she was to conduct that evaluation was left entirely to her discretion. And that discretion isn't exactly what is entitled to be protected by quasi-judicial immunity.
Well, I would like to take us back to the record, because that's frankly my biggest issue in this case. A Rule 12 motion, the district court is to focus on the pleading submitted by the party seeking relief, in this case, the plaintiff, correct? That's the pleading that the court is evaluating under Rule 12 to see if it states a claim upon which relief can be granted, correct?
It is allowed to look at both the complaint and the answer, Your Honor, under Rule 12.
And it's the answer that attaches the appointment order, because the complaint doesn't have anything about the appointment order referenced, correct? The complaint simply alleges that your client was the custody evaluator. Didn't even reference it being court appointed, but just said that she was the custody evaluator for the parties, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
If we disagree with your interpretation of the scope of our record, did the district court, in essence, convert this to summary judgment by considering the appointment order? And should we do the same?
If this court disagrees with my interpretation of the record, then yes, the trial court would have converted it to a summary judgment, and in conflict with its own internally stated language that it did not do so.
Counsel,
and in which case, if it was converted.
On that point, I believe there is case law that says on a Rule 12 motion, for example, in a contract case, there's a complaint sets out a claim of breach of contract. The complaint specifically mentions the contract. I believe there's case law saying, you know, in those situations, you can look at the contract or the document which is specifically referenced in the complaint and the basis for the cause of action without converting the motion to summary judgment. I'm having a hard time understanding why that principle wouldn't apply here. If the complaint mentions the court-ordered appointment, can we look at that court-ordered appointment without converting to summary judgment?
I think part of it is the fact that, perhaps in here, neither party, either respondent in this matter or the appellant has in any way raised the issue that the trial court strayed beyond the record on a Rule 12 motion by taking into account the fact that she was a court-appointed custody evaluator. And I don't believe anyone has raised that as an issue that it was improper for the trial court to consider that appointment.
So your argument is simply that that's part of the record, the fact that your client was appointed by the court, and that because the complaint did not allege that the actions she took that formed the defamation claim were outside the scope of her authority as a court appointed. I mean, that's your argument, that because they did not raise that in their complaint, that Rule 12 dismissal is appropriate. Am I right about that?
Yes, I think it goes... we can step it a bit further in terms of the fact that quasi-judicial immunity would to be defeated would have to find some underlying conduct that strayed beyond the scope of her appointment. The complaint itself, the only cause of action is defamation. And defamation is historically protected against, parties are historically protected against claims of defamation by quasi-judicial immunity. In addition, we have the issue of Rule 706 immunity, witness immunity. She was court appointed to serve as an expert. The case law in Minnesota was clear that the order doesn't have to follow the formalities for that appointment to take place. And in that particular immunity, for both immunities, communications can happen beyond the court proceeding itself. I mean, at some point, these experts have to gather information, have to share information, have to learn more about the cases in order to conduct their duties.
Mr. Casper, I have a question about, again, about the record, following up on my colleague's question. So did you file a motion pursuant to Rule 12.02, which has to do with failure to state a claim, or Rule 12.03, which would judgment on the pleadings, which might encompass both the complaint and the answer? Your brief refers to 12.03, but the district court specifically referred to 12.02E.
If I recall correctly, Your Honor, I believe I referenced 12.03. And I don't have it in front of me to, I believe my notice of motion to motion specifically stated Rule 12.03.
And was there some point in district court proceedings, such as at the hearing on the motion, where this matter was discussed? Was there any discussion about the distinction between 12.02 and 12.03?
I don't recall that distinction being made by the trial court or by counsel at that hearing. I don't remember that being a focal point of the arguments, Your Honor.
Judge Bjorkman, your mic is muted.
May I ask, I know his time is up. Yes. Can I ask one more question?
Please proceed.
I'm looking at your reply brief in footnote 3, and you make the statement that appellant does not concede that in order to pierce appellant's quasi-judicial immunity, respondent would be required to actually plead she was acting out of office. I'm not sure what you're saying. Are you saying you don't agree? Are you saying you dispute that she must actually plead? I was uncertain what you were saying in that sentence.
I believe, if I recall correctly, Your Honor, what I was referencing in that particular comment is the concern in this case that in comparison to Kubreka, there were clear allegations that occurred out of office in that case. It was prior to appointment. In this particular case, with the respondent on notice from the first complaint to the second amended complaint. And I believe even prior to, although it's beyond the record, was aware of her court appointment, was aware of the issues of quasi-judicial immunity. And I believe we still have to see some allegations contained in the complaint beyond just the fact that defamation occurred. Because defamation could occur in any setting.
If Judge Bjorkman is satisfied with your answer, then I think, and if there are no further questions, then I think your time has expired, Mr. Casper. So we are now at the point where we ordinarily would hear argument from Respondents' Counsel. And
hello.
Okay, Mr. Tanik, I can hear you. I can hear you, Mr. Tanik.
I can hear you fine, Judge.
Okay, very good. I'm glad. I wasn't aware that you were able to make a connection. So have you?
I just connected. Excuse me, Judge. I just connected about 10 seconds ago. So I just did. I've been trying with Judge Siegel's assistance here. I've been trying all kinds of machinations. I think this is the seventh try I've had at it, but all of a sudden I'm now connected somehow, just on voice.
Okay, well, we can hear you, and I think both judges can hear you. I believe Mr. Casper can hear you as well, correct, Mr. Casper?
I can, Your Honor.
So we are ready for argument from respondents. You have 15 minutes. I understand that sounds like you were not able to hear Mr. Casper's oral argument, but nonetheless, you may present oral argument in favor of your client's position and upholding the district court's order. And of course, you will also be available for questions from counsel. So you may proceed, Mr. Tanner.
I hope you said I'd be available for questions from counsel. I hope counsel doesn't ask me any questions.
I have enough time with the court's questions. That's what I meant. I apologize to add to our confusion. So anyway, Mr. Panic, you may proceed with argument on behalf of respondent.
Thank you. I'll start with my own apology. I apologize for causing this inconvenience and delay. I don't know what caused it or why. I've had more than a dozen Zoom hearings since COVID, and none of them have been a problem. And in fact, last week I had an argument before this tribunal. Judge Larkin was on that panel, and it worked out fine. So I don't know what happened this morning, but I apologize for it if I did anything on my end. I did hear parts of Mr. Casper's argument and parts of the court's questioning. So it kind of came in and out. So I was able to follow a little bit of that. And so that'll help a little bit, but I'll try to be kind of brief here and move through my arguments fairly quickly, because I know the court's familiar with the record in this case. It's a very slender record on a Rule 12 motion, but Mr. Dahl, who I represent, was the subject of these rather four vile accusations that he raped a minor, that he was a sex offender, that he was a physical danger to a child, and he physically abused a child. Under Rule 12, as a Rule 12 motion, these are all deemed to be false, and indeed they are false. These statements were made by the child custody evaluator, Pamela Quinn, in a meeting with the parties and counsel. Mr. Dahl was not present. I think the court did focus on the critical issue in this case, which is whether she was acting within the scope of her duties or scope of appointment. The appointment in this case, which was agreed to by stipulation between the parties, was very scant, to say the least, and the court order adopting the stipulation was equally scant. It mentions that Ms. Quinn was appointed as the child custody evaluator. It doesn't reference or recite what her duties are. It doesn't recite or reference the statute for that matter either, 518.167.
Mr. Tanick, I'm going to stop you just for a minute to ask this question, and that is, doesn't your failure in the complaint to allege that Ms. Quinn acted outside of her role as court-appointed custody evaluator, isn't that fatal to your claim going forward, given the various immunities that may be at play?
No, for a number of reasons, Your Honor. First of all, as pointed out, this is a notice pleading state. We pled a defamation cause of action. Immunity is a defense. Whether the defendant would raise it or not is up to the defendant. And generally, a plaintiff does not have to allege in a complaint the non-existence or negate potential defenses.
How is this any different than a situation where a statute of limitations may be at play? And you would plead then not only the elements of the tort, but also a reason why a statute of limitations may have been told, for example. I mean, wouldn't that be something you'd have to allege in your pleading to survive a Rule 12 dismissal?
No, not necessarily. Again, a statute of limitations is a defense. It's an affirmative defense to be raised by the other party. Generally, a plaintiff does not have to allege in a complaint, in a notice pleading complaint, the non-existence of defenses or explain away defenses. That's for the defendant to raise. And then once that's raised, it may become the subject of a motion of some type, usually on a summary judgment basis. But it's not a plaintiff's obligation to negate a potential defense that hasn't even been raised. We didn't know if they would raise this defense or not. They're entitled to raise the defense, but we don't have to allege in our complaint the non-existence of defenses that haven't been raised. So I don't think that's fatal at all. If it were in any respect to be deemed necessary or appropriate, then one appropriate remedy would be to remand and allow us to replead the complaint. I don't think we have to, but of course, under Rule 15, with leave freely granted, we could amend the complaint to assert that the non-existence of a defense. but I don't think we have to, but if necessary, we could. And given the fact that the case is in its early stage, the case has been around for a long time because of this appeal, but there'd be no prejudice to the other party in allowing us to amend the complaint if warranted. But as I said, I don't think we have to. The key issue in this case is whether Ms. Quinn exceeded the scope of her appointment. As I noted, incidentally, I can't see the timer, so I don't know I'm trying to time it myself here. But
could I stop you, please?
Yes.
This is Judge Larkin.
Yes,
there
Judge.
Seems to be a dispute regarding whether Ms. Quinn's motion for dismissal under Rule 12 was based on Rule 1202, that is, failure to state a claim on which relief can be granted, or Rule 1203, motion for judgment on the pleadings. Do you recall how the motion was styled in district court?
I'm pretty sure, Your Honor, but I'm not absolutely sure. I'm pretty sure it was a Rule 1202 motion for dismissal. It was not, I don't believe, a judgment on the pleadings. I'm almost certain of that because I know in our briefing below and in this court too, we argued Rule 12.02, we argued the standard for motion to dismiss. It was not asserted, I don't believe, as a motion for judgment on the pleadings, which would further advance the argument I just made about why it's not necessary to defuse or immunity defense. But the statute, but the appointment here did not reference Ms. Quinn's duties, nor did it even reference the statute. What happened here, as the court is aware, is Ms. Quinn made these comments about Mr. Dahl, a non-party, in a conference or meeting she had with counsel and the parties. That was not the trial court had allowed or assigned a stipulation that the meeting could go forward because they had exceeded the time periods in the court scheduling order, but there was no acquiescence at all by the court, no approval by the court of Ms. Quinn conducting this meeting or indeed making these defamatory statements in the meeting, so they weren't authorized in any sense. Ms. Quinn did never prepare a report. The statute, although not provided for in the appointment itself, the
Mr.
statute
Tanik,
states.
What difference yes. does it make that the defamatory statements weren't reduced to writing? Why does that make a difference?
I think it could make a difference. I don't think it has to make a difference, but the statute provides, the statute under which the appointment presumably was made, although it doesn't reference that, says that the scope of duties of a custody evaluator is to undertake an investigation and report. And therefore it would suggest that an evaluator, custody evaluator's duties are to investigate and then render a report to the court. There's nothing in the statute that authorizes the evaluator, once appointed, to engage in a meeting with the parties in which defamatory statements are made about a third party if it's not reduced to a report. It could well be that had that been reduced to a report, some of the judicial and quasi-judicial immunity might arguably apply. I don't know that it necessarily would apply in that case, but at least there'd be a stronger argument for quasi-judicial immunity if the custody evaluator is preparing a report, because then she would be acting within the express scope of the statutory duties. Here she wasn't. There's nothing in the court appointment or the statute that provides for that kind of free-range, free-roaming license to libel, which occurred here, of a third party. What happened here, in our view, is that Ms. Quinn, the evaluator, went rogue. She had no authority to call the parties together, and even if she did, as part of her overall duties, she had no authority to make defamatory statements about a third party that was not contained and to be embodied in some type of report to the court.
Mr. Tanik?
Yes.
Judge Larkin?
Yes.
Yes,
Judge.
If this court were to conclude that relief under Rule 12 was properly denied, does that prevent in any way Ms. Quinn from raising the potential application of immunity based on a more fulsome record?
No.
Okay. So this case should be resolved at this date with a decision regarding the application of these three immunities as a matter of law for either side. Your position is too soon to tell, we need to we need more facts about whether or not this was in the scope of the duties.
Well, we would certainly welcome that kind of ruling saying that the defenses don't apply as a matter of law, but quite frankly, given the scant record that we have, their sparse record and the narrow Rule 12 standard, we think the court below properly determined that there was factual disputes concerning what happened here, why Ms. Quinn undertook these made these defamatory statements, and what the context and circumstances were, which are not embodied in the pleadings before the court under Rule 12. They're not embodied in our pleadings. They're not involved in the defense pleadings. So it would certainly, in answer to your question, Judge, we don't think that any of those defenses do apply, any of those immunities do apply, but recognizing the nature of the record, we would at a minimum say that the case should be affirmed and remanded for further development of the record. And it may well be that at some point in the proceedings, probably on a summary judgment type motion, when the facts are developed, that Ms. Quinn could raise that argument again. We don't think it'd be successful, but we don't know what the facts are because we haven't conducted any discovery yet. So to answer your question is, we're not saying that as a matter of law, this court should or must determine that those defenses don't apply, although we would welcome such a ruling. But we are saying that under the standard for Rule 12, this appeal should be denied or dismissed, and the matter remanded to allow the case to move forward with the opportunity for Ms. Quinn to raise whatever appropriate argument she has as the case proceeds. And I think it's important to recognize in terms of these defenses here that the expert witness defense argument we do think doesn't apply as a matter of law. There's a specific procedure under Rule 706 for dealing with expert witnesses appointed by the court. Ms. Quinn was not appointed by the court under Rule 706. And the case that's cited for that proposition by the respondent, the Paterka case, was a case when an accountant was appointed by a court and was given broad powers expressly to conduct an evaluation of a business in connection with a divorce. There, the expert was appointed as an expert and was given broad powers under the expert witness statute. That doesn't apply here, where the statute is quite limited. The statute for custody evaluates 518.176 provides very narrow, specifically defined duties for a custody evaluator, including investigation and report, and it doesn't provide for any kind of free-ranging, free-roaming ability to defame third parties in a way that doesn't comport with either the appointment or the statute. So we think there are fact disputes that preclude overturning the trial court decision, which we believe is right. One final argument that respondent makes is kind of a policy argument that custody evaluators should not be deterred from engaging in their activities by fear of defamation or other types of lawsuits. And we don't disagree with that. We think that the custody evaluators or any court appointee shouldn't be deterred, but there's an equally countervailing policy against upholding the reputational rights of third parties to a dispute, like Mr. Dahl, who was not involved in this dispute. His reputational rights are important, and they ought to be taken into account too in balancing any kind of policy interests or policy issues. We don't think this case turns on policy issues. I think it turns on Rule 12, the standard of review under Rule 12. But to the extent that there are policy considerations, they certainly favor giving an opportunity for a third party to protect and preserve his reputation against these rather scurrilous and false accusations made against him in a case in which he was not even a party to the proceeding. So we maintain, Your Honor, that Ms. Quinn was acting outside the scope of her duties, both in terms of the appointment and the statute. At a minimum, there are factual disputes concerning the scope of her duties, what she did, how she did it, why she did it, and the circumstances that preclude dismissing this case on a Rule 12 motion. We would ask, therefore, that the decision below be affirmed and the matter remanded for further proceedings. Thank you very much. And again, I apologize for the inconvenience I caused everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Tanik. Your apology is, of course, accepted. We understand this is many hazards, many things that can go wrong in trying to do this, but we appreciate your attempts to make it work. Mr. Casper, you will have an opportunity for rebuttal. I'm waiting for the clock to be set to 5 minutes, and then you may proceed.
Muted.
You're still muted, Mr. Casper.
Can you hear me now, Your Honor?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Kinnick. There's a circular logic at play here that if a trial court doesn't authorize defamation, a person protected by quasi-judicial immunity is acting beyond the scope of their authority. Mr. Tanik did not dispute, in fact, conceded in his argument that the trial court approved her attendance at that meeting on July 12, 2018. That cloaked that meeting in quasi-judicial immunity. That's not in dispute. The second piece then that I'm concerned about in this case is if we look in Mr. Tanik's argument that the order was brief, that the order did not even reference the statute, if we look at Sierra Dinsmore versus Knorr, which is referenced in my brief, a party is still entitled to protection of quasi-judicial immunity when they make their own interpretation of a vague or ambiguous court order. It's easy to comply with a crystal clear court order. What we have here is an order that didn't reference the statute, that allowed her to attend the meeting, and none of those facts are in dispute. The question becomes, should she be protected for attending that meeting and conducting that meeting in a manner which she believed was authorized and which is conceded was authorized by the trial court?
Counsel?
If there was...
Have you had a chance during the break to look at your file to see whether the basis for your motion was 1203 or 1202?
I didn't have it in front of me, Your Honor. I apologize.
That's fine. Thank you.
I tried to find it. So I guess that's the concern I have in terms of the response and the rebuttals I make, and that is the fact that the order conceitedly was ambiguous, and the fact that her attendance at that meeting was approved. The claim of conduct, the defamation itself, can't be unauthorized by a trial court, can't be the basis to exceed quasi-judicial immunity. That's problematic. And in this particular case, I would raise the point that the public policy interests are always balanced, but the Cardinal rule in Minnesota is the best interests of the children come first. There is no dispute. Yes, Your Honor.
Let me ask this. Here's my concern. I think you've got a very strong argument. Had these statements been put into a report and submitted to the court, or had your client testified at a hearing regarding the recommendations? But that's not what we have here. We have sort of a meeting to discuss what the recommendations are going to be. I find myself wondering if your client might have been more careful with her word choices in a formal report that was going to be filed with the court or in court under oath, then perhaps she was in a closed door meeting with a couple of parties. And that's what causes me to think this issue of whether or not this meeting was within the scope of judicial duties is such an important one. Even if we do look at your responsive pleading, assuming your motion papers say you move for relief under 1203 and not 1202, as your opposition and the district court have said, why is it that the pleadings enable us to determine to the level necessary what the facts are such that we could, you know, for the first time, undoubtedly in a published opinion, say that your client was entitled to immunity as a matter of law in this case?
Well, I would start with the fact that the respondent in this particular case has conceded the fact that she was there at that meeting pursuant to an approval of the trial court.
How did he concede that?
He just stated that on the record that the trial court approved her attendance at that meeting.
Let's say we didn't view the record that way. What would your argument be?
I believe the argument either way is the fact that if we're going to err, we need to err on the side of protecting the immunities. We need to err on the side of the fact that this case will open the issue.
Counsel?
Yes.
Are the immunities not protected if the parties are allowed to engage in some discovery and the judge is then presented this issue of first impression, very important issue with great significance? What is the harm of more fully developing the record regarding what the district court ordered, if anything, regarding this meeting and the purpose of the meeting and the district court envisions that as being a part of the investigation and preparation of this report? I feel like there are so many questions unanswered. I'm having a hard time understanding how we would make the important decision, a first impression, that a custody evaluator is entitled to judicial immunity in these circumstances.
I think in terms of that, quasi-judicial immunity is also entitled, or is designed to shield parties of the expense of litigation. And while this is an important case, the issue of court appointment has already been discussed by the Court of Appeals in immunity for custody evaluators. And if we're going to look at a custody evaluator, and if defamatory statements in a court-approved conference take her out of quasi-judicial immunity, that's going to have broad implications to everyone, from judges, the prosecutors, the county attorneys, regarding quasi-judicial immunity.
But nothing says she had to do this meeting. I've seen plenty of custody reports as a district court judge and as an appellate judge where there is no meeting, as occurred in this case. So I'm having a hard time understanding the argument that a custody evaluator can't do his or her job unless the evaluator meets with the parties to go through the recommendations as a group, which is essentially what you're saying.
It's not a matter of whether or not she can do her job. It's a matter of, did she have the discretion to take that action? That action that was participating in that conference being approved by the trial court was within her discretion.
Okay, thank you.
Because that's the nature of quasi-judicial immunity. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Casper. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is deemed submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The court is now in recess.
The marshal.